ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts, Hal Bryan, EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications. And over there at the other end of the table, it is...
I'm Chris Henry. I'm the museum manager here at EAA.
And Chris, we've got a guest joining us through the magic of the internet. Why don't you tell us who that is and what we're going to talk about?
Absolutely. It's someone I actually go back a few years with, although I just had a really great experience with them last week, and we thought it'd be fun to share them with you guys here on the Green Dot. And it's Jeff Kilpinen. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, my favorite question I like to ask, and Hal's laughing because he knows that it's where I'm going.
It's mine
with it.
Too.
I know it, and everybody has a story. And I always like to ask, where did you first get your start in aviation? What first got you interested?
I guess I'd have to credit that to my dear father. He grew up on a farm in Ironwood, Michigan, in the western part of the Upper Peninsula, and had a love for airplanes. And interestingly, he would relate to me stories when he was a boy. Down the road was a field where barnstormers would come in and land after the hay was cut. And he used to run down the road and watch people go for rides. And he didn't know what kind of airplane it was at that time. But as I piqued my interest in flying, he told me that he can remember that biplane being there, and he could see the rocker arms going back and forth. You know, they were exposed. And I said, Dad, that was an OX-5 engine, and it was probably a Jenny. But he said the guy would come every year at a certain time and hop rides. And so he, like a lot of kids in that era, and that would be in the 20s, you know, because my father was born in 1915. But he would help the pilot and, you know, run and get gas and some things like that. And he was supposed to go for a ride then this following morning. And evidently, my grandfather had a dream that night. And he dreamt that as the airplane was going up with my father on it, that he saw balls of fire falling off the landing gear, and he had a bad feeling about him going in a premonition. So the morning of my father's proposed ride in that airplane, my grandfather spoke to him and said, Son, I really don't want you to go on that airplane. I had a bad dream and everything else. So my father, being the obedient son, didn't go. But my dad later on understood what that story meant to him, because Dad talked about the fact that when those barnstormers would take off from that fresh-cut hay field there, that there was clumps of hay that stuck in the landing gear, and he'd see those clumps of hay falling off the landing gear as he climbed out. Well, I suppose he might have related that to my grandfather. Maybe he saw that, but that's interesting that he would remember that kind of detail. But my father always loved airplanes. In fact, on the farm there, he started to actually build his own airplane. He told me he carved his own propeller. He had a Harley-Davidson motorcycle engine. Unfortunately, no one had a camera back then to take a picture of it. He never got it to the point where it was completed or was going to fly. But he had a love for aviation and kind of conveyed that to me. I'm the youngest of four. And prior to me being born, he'd take my sisters and my brother to air shows down in the Detroit area, because he eventually ended up working in research for Ford Motor Company. So there was a connection there with the interest, but I was the one that actually took it beyond that. And so I was fortunate in that my father's older sister, my Aunt Ellen's farm, was right on the north side of the airport in Ironwood, Michigan. And my cousin Adrian Hockery started, like young boys did in those days, start working at the airport as a line boy and sweeping floors and doing such things like that. And eventually, he married the airport manager, John or Jocko Cavari's one daughter, Kathy. There were six girls in that family, and I suppose we were all his surrogate sons. But nevertheless, my cousin Adrian and Kathy got married, and learned to fly in a Piper Clipper. So that was great, because I can remember when I was a boy, when they'd come to visit us down in Detroit or whenever we went up there, I always went to the farm, and Aunt Ellen had a big willow tree right there by the road, and I'd sit in that tree, and I can remember North Central Airlines coming in with DC-3s and landing there, and I would watch airplanes all day. So when I got to be a little bit more serious about it, my cousin Adrian said, well, If you're serious about it, I'll talk to, Jocko about you possibly doing the same thing that I did. So at age 13, I started to realize that dream. And I started working for Jocko at the airport and doing the very same things that my cousin did and some other kids ahead of the time did the same thing and swept floors and pumped gas. And I really owe my career in aviation to my father, to my cousin Adrian, and to Jocko Cavari, because my father provided the spark and the interest. My cousin Adrian showed me the way, and his father-in-law, Jocko Cavari, put it to reality, basically for me, to do this very same thing. So I spent every year of my high school years from age 13 on in 1968. I was growing up down in Dearborn, Michigan. So I'd go up and spend the summer initially with my Aunt Ellen and dream about flying. And I learned to fly in the very same airplane, the Piper Clipper. So I spent every year of my high school years, my summers, working 7 days a week at the airport. And I was given opportunities that, really, I look back at it now at my age and realize that how fortunate I really was. But even more importantly, that Jocko Cavari gave me the opportunities and others like me that worked there. Things that you would never get in life. I mean, we were basically running the airport on Saturday mornings at 14 years old. We had a key. We would run credit cards for people's fuel purchases and pull their airplanes out. And it's just amazing when I look back at it now and understand how much trust and faith he placed in us. So, but he was a wonderful instructor and mentor in so many things, not just about airplanes, but life in general. So that's how it all got started for me. And I soloed on my 16th birthday. Actually, down in Detroit, because my birthday was actually about a week and a half ago. So November in Ironwood is not a good time. So I ended up soloing in a 7ECA Citabria down in what used to be the Oakland Orion Airport, or prior to that, Allen Airport down in the Pontiac area. It's now no longer an airport. But I was able to solo like my cousin did, but I actually learned to fly in the very same airplane, the Piper Clipper.
Wow, that's really spectacular. You know, Jeff, something you said really struck me, that you... you look back on this and you realize how fortunate you were. And, I think all of us, as we get older, develop a very appropriate spirit of gratitude. And it's great to see that you're looking back like that. But it's also interesting for me on the outside as an observer to look at your life and say, the old aphorisms about so much of luck being just showing up. And, when you're that young, and you're so dedicated that that you're there 7 days a week. You strike me as the kind of guy who's too humble to say so, but I don't mind saying that you made a lot of your own good fortune just by being there, just by showing up. And so kudos to you for seeing what you wanted and being willing to go after it at such a young age.
Well, thank you. The interesting thing also is that I remember I'd go back down to Detroit to have to go to school, and I begged my parents to live with one of my aunts up there so I could go to school and work at the airport year-round. But nevertheless, I'd go back, and my school buddies, I'd say, hey, well, what'd you do this summer? And they'd say very dejectedly, well, we were kind of bored. We'd maybe play baseball a little bit or do whatever. Here I was driving trucks, jeeps, working on airplanes, learning to fly. I mean... The life experiences that were given to us, it boggles my mind at times. And I'm very thankful and grateful that, not only was I presented with those opportunities, but was able to take advantage of it. And Jocko was just an amazing person. Really, I can tell you he was a very gifted man, learned an open cockpit biplane with a helmet and goggles and things of that nature. So the things I learned about flying go back to that era. And I can still hear his voice to this day when I fly my own airplanes, and I've given some instruction to other people, because he was a man that was all about values, okay? And there was value in everything. There was value in people. There was value in the way you learn to fly. And I would imagine a lot of instructors are like that. I never spent any time doing any instruction in my particular career path. But when you have these opportunities, and I was so grateful, as I mentioned before, because I had this passion for aviation, and unlike my friends back down at school, by the grace of God, I never had to worry about what I wanted to be when I grew up. I am extremely thankful for the opportunity that was presented to me and the fact that I knew what I wanted to do and was able to make that happen. So that's for any young man or woman that wants to get in flying, you know, it's a passion. And I see it all the time when I go to AirVenture, you know, and I've been going to Oshkosh since 1971. My cousins and I hitchhiked down there the first time in 71. And that's when I joined EAA. And we went down there with sleeping bags and threw them on the ground, you know, and just stayed right amongst the airplanes. And, you know, you see this passion about aviation and people from all walks of life, of all different backgrounds. And, you know, Paul Poberesny had a vision that was truly amazing, you know, and I just look at it now. And there was a time when I had met Paul, you know, over the years then a couple of times, but I didn't expect him to remember me. But you know, I was moved to do something, and once again, I'm thankful that the opportunity presented itself. And I don't remember the exact year, but it's the year that Boeing brought the 787 into Oshkosh. And I was hoping that I'd get a chance to just have a private time with him, just to tell him what he meant to me. And amazingly enough, I was over there looking at the 787, and here comes Paul and Audrey driving up in Red One, and they came right up to the nose gear and parked there for a second. And it was as if, you know, my dream was answered. He drove up there, and there was no one else around. I walked up to him, and I said, Paul, and I put my hand out, and I introduced myself, and I said, you know, that I used to be a ferry pilot for the Eagles and all that. But I said, you know, I just want to tell you something. I said, and I mean this with all my heart, that I believe that you have impacted more people in this world about aviation and affected more people's lives about aviation than any one human being that has ever been born. And, you know, he was holding my hand and he got tears in his eyes, and I will never forget this. He raised my hand up. He was holding my hand the whole time and he kissed my hand. And I'll tell you, you know, you still get emotional thinking about that to this day, because that's what he meant to me and so many other people worldwide. He created a movement, and here we all, we're all part of that. We're kind of, for a lack of a better description, disciples of Paul Poberesny, what he created. And I just think he's one of the most magnificent people, but by far the most influential aviator in history.
You're here.
Well said. Wow. That's awesome. I'm glad you had that moment with him, at AirVenture. That's super special. And it really, for those who maybe haven't come or for those who do come and know, I mean, it's kind of one of those beautiful things about AirVenture, and that really hit me when I first started coming here, was I always said there were no ropes around the airplanes or the heroes. I mean, you'd be just sort of walking around and run into this legend of aviation getting ice cream, you know, and
you're exactly, you know, right.
And usually would be kind enough to share a minute with you. It's just really, it's a really special dynamic here. That's for sure.
Every year that I go, it calls into my memory that all the experiences I've had over the years with my children and the people that I brought there, that I've met there, and I continue to see there. And you know, you like Paul said, you know, you go for the airplanes, but you actually end up meeting the people, and that was the big thing for him. And I think that's true for everyone that attends there.
Absolutely, yeah, I completely agree. Well, as we're talking about those experiences, what was next in your aviation sort of journey? Where did you go after you learned to fly? And I know we're working our way toward talking about the Eagles team, you know, from a professional side, what were you doing? How did you get there?
Well, I went a year of junior college up there in Ironwood after I graduated from high school in 1972. I moved to Ironwood permanently, and I actually got into broadcasting. I did a brief stint as a disc jockey, if you can imagine, 18 years old for WJMS, their AM station in Ironwood. And then I returned back to Detroit, and I immediately got a job at what used to be the Gros Isle Naval Air Station on the Detroit River there at the mouth of Lake Erie, you know, mouth where of Detroit River, it empties into Lake Erie. And I had been an explorer Boy Scout, and I took my ground school via our explorer post chapter there. And so we had done a field trip out there when I was in high school to the Naval Air Station, and never imagining that just a few years later, after they decommissioned it and made it a municipal airport, I'd be working there. So I went out and got a job there, and I was doing the same thing. I was pumping fuel. Then I was a mechanics assistant. I was working towards getting my A&P, which regrettably I didn't follow through and do. But I started finishing my rating, so I got my private license there. And, you know, people come along in your life that help you. And there was a man named Bob Arnold there who had been a former crane operator. And he took an early out from one of the steel companies where he worked. But he loved aviation. And he was a CFI. He started a flying school. And Bob Arnold was one of those men that if to see him, you wouldn't imagine that he was the type of guy he was. But he was one of those people that could teach anyone to fly. I've always said that not everybody is a born pilot. I don't know if there's necessarily such a thing, but you have to be able to learn to be a pilot. And not all people can learn to be a pilot. But I'm telling you, I saw Bob Arnold teach people to fly who had been given up by other instructors trying to teach them, and it just didn't click. But he was a salt of the earth kind of guy. Maybe his language is a little bit salty at times, but he was probably one of the most wonderful instructors I ever had to deal with. And I got my finished my private with him, and then I started going to Eastern Michigan University, and we had a flying club at Eastern Michigan with a 172. So of course I joined that. There weren't many members there. So then what I did is I went from working there at Gros Isle Airport over to Detroit Metropolitan Airport. And I worked for one of the fixed base operators there. This would have been 1974 or 75 era, Page Airways, which eventually merged with Butler and now became Signature, nationwide fixed base operator. But so there I was fueling airplanes there. And my first day on the job, I fueled a British Airways 747. And you know, it's amazing. And so we had contracts to fuel the airlines, British Airways, Allegheny that at that time, Trans World Airlines, Braniff. And then we, of course, serviced corporate airplanes. So I like to tell people I've fueled everything from a J3 to a 747 and everything in between. And so that's what paid the bills. I worked midnights there and maybe swing shifts or whatever so I could go to college during the daytime. Then take that money and go finish my ratings. And being that it was Detroit back in the 70s, there was a whole bunch of Part 135 air taxi operators that flew car parts around because of the auto industry. And so I never actually went the CFI route because I was getting all this time flying in these twin beaches, you know, Beach 18s. And even some of them, some companies had turbine Beach 18s. And so I got to go and fly along. And a lot of the guys, that was still when the airmail was being flown cross country by the Postal Service. You know, they had different contractors, Part 135 operators. And I got to know some of those guys because they'd come in at night and I'd fuel them up. Well, then they'd say, hey, you know, if you ever want to go to Chicago or wherever, you can fly along. Well, they were only too happy to have me in the right seat because I was kind of their autopilot. I flew the airplane while they slept. And so I did all of that stuff and continued my education. And then probably, I got some jobs then flying for 135 operators, flying Beach 18s. One up company, we had a Skymaster, we had a 402. And then that led to another job over at Detroit Willow Run, which was the hub of all cargo flying out of the Detroit metropolitan area and somewhat still is today. But so I did a lot of the same things that my contemporaries were doing, this same thing, working for different companies. And I guess kind of, if you want to call your big break, I got hired by Zantop Airways. It was Zantop International, which was a 121 carrier, but the one brother, Lloyd Zantop, started Zantop Airways at Detroit Metro, and they had Learjet 23s and Gulfstream 1s, G159s, that they converted into freighters. Well, I was very fortunate at the age of 23 to get hired flying Learjet. So they, I had done a little corporate flying in an MU-2 with a guy named Don Carter. Flew for Kent Moore Corporation out of Willow Run. So I had some turbine time plus what I had flown with the Twin Beaches. And then this opportunity was given to me to go fly the Learjet, which you can imagine at 23 years old, getting to fly Learjet was a real, real thrill. Amazing, amazing airplane. The only airplane I can ever recall, you know, there's a speed limit below 10,000 feet of 250 knots for all airplanes. And that's the only airplane I've ever flown as a civilian that when you got at 10,000 feet, you lowered the nose, increased your airspeed, and increased your rate of climb. Never seen an airplane do that. But we'd routinely go from Detroit Whale and Run, it was about 600 feet above sea level, to 41,000 feet in about 11 minutes.
Wow.
And it was an amazing airplane. And so we were flying auto parts in that realm as well. And then my company, Zantop Airways, sold the airplanes to an outfit which eventually became U.S. Airways, which then we sold the name to the current U.S. Airways, which merged with American. But anyway, that's kind of complicated. But so they were contracted Emory Air Freight. They had DC-8s and Convair 580s, and they bought these three Learjets. Well, then I went with the airplanes. They offered for us to stay at Zantop or go with the airplanes, and I went with the airplanes like the rest of us did. And then shortly thereafter, I got based in Miami, and we were flying under contract to Emory Air Freight. And so down there, I moved down to Florida, and I was a first officer there. And so we had three crews, as I recall, and we flew scheduled service from Miami to Jacksonville to Dayton, Ohio, which was the hub for Emory, on the ground for 4 hours, and then back to Jacksonville, back to Miami. We'd take off at about 9 o'clock at night and get back at about 6 a.m. and did that Monday through Friday night, and did that 2 weeks on and a week off. And eventually, I made captain then the following spring at 24 years old, and then we added a second airplane on the Emory schedule that flew out of Tampa, and I did that until we finally downsized the Learjet operation, and I flew the very last Learjet trip. We sold the airplanes, and then they merged. I was the only pilot left that they wanted to continue from the Learjet operation into the Convair 580, so I, at 25 years old, went straight to the left seat of a Convair 580. So they put me in the right seat for about a month or so to get experience on the airplane because they had enough seniority to be a captain. But that was like going from driving a Ferrari to a dump truck because the Learjet you flew with your fingertips, the autopilots didn't always work. So you were hand flying at 41,000 feet. But, you had all these small little gauges. Everything in a Lear is like jewel-sized gauges and everything else. Now you get in a Convair, it's like going aboard a ship. You know, you got big levers and knobs and gauges. And it was not a boosted control airplane. So literally, I mean, it was a handful to fly that airplane. But extremely great airplane with the turbine engines. It was really a powerful airplane and very, very stable airplane. So then I flew that for about a year and a half, maybe almost 2 years on the Emory system. We got rid of the DC-8s and the Learjets at the same time and then increased our fleet of Convair 580s. And then, fortunately, in 1981, we acquired 727s. And so, again, being right place, right time, at 26 years old, I went straight to the left seat of 727 and started flying the 727 on the same Emory schedule. And I had flight engineers, that were old enough to be my father. And these were guys that I knew by flying out of Willow Run. They'd worked for some of the other cargo carriers. But, they were real pros because I can only imagine if I was their age, you get some 26-year-old kid in the left seat. but they treated you a professional. You know, as long as you did the job, we all got along. It was a wonderful experience. And as a side note there, the owner of our airline, we changed our name to Interstate Airlines. He was into thoroughbred racehorses. And so we got a contract to fly thoroughbred racehorses during the racing season for a freight horse forwarder by the name of Tex Sutton out of Lexington, Kentucky. And I was chosen to be the first captain checked out by the chief pilot to do it. And the horses had been traveling cross country on Electras prior to that. And we were the first ones in the country to fly thoroughbred racehorses on a jet. So I got checked out doing that, and that was daytime flying, and they catered it, and we had a crew of seven guys in the back that handled the horses. They worked for Tex Sutton, and so anytime there was a horse charter came up, I was the one that flew it, and the co-pilots loved it because they weren't allowed to touch the airplane as long as there was horses on, so I had to do all the flying when we were hauling horses, but they loved it because they ate and talked on the radio, so, that was really interesting because I got to know the thoroughbred racing industry and Coletta Charters eventually took over that flying from us and was still doing that in a 727. But it was interesting. We had a 727-100, and we could carry 18 thoroughbred racehorses at one time. And I was hauling all these, the most important racehorses of that time, and that was in 81 and 82, and flying some of the storied trainers, you know, that had been involved in the thoroughbred racing industry. So I learned a lot about that, and you had to kind of like animals, because when you went to the hotel, you smelled like you spent the day at the county fair, because we used to have competition on the flights up front. We'd be, the door would open up and there was horse flies everywhere in the cockpit. So, mind you, we'd be flying with our own individual fly swatters, and we'd see who could kill the most flies between Lexington and Ontario, California. It was a lot of fun. It was, like I say, it was great because it was daytime flying. We got treated really well. So I enjoyed that a lot. And and then that led to me getting hired at Southwest Airlines then in November of 1982. So I, at the age of 28 years old, that was my birthday present. I got hired a week after my 28th birthday, and I spent 37 years at Southwest Airlines and retired in 2019.
Wow. Now, how did you come across and meet and become a ferry pilot for the Eagles? That's an amazing part of your story as well.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I have to tell you, when I got hired in 1982 at Southwest Airlines, my cousin's wife, Kathy, her sister, Doreen, ended up marrying Charlie Hillard. And so I knew that Doreen was down in Texas. And so they said, hey, gee, that's great. You'll get to see Charlie and Doreen. So I kind of reconnected with Doreen when I went to Dallas in 82. And so here I had a chance now to meet one of the guys that I idolized by going to Oshkosh and everything is, when they were the Red Devils and everything else. So and Charlie was such a wonderful man. Well, so I started visiting them when I had my time off from flying at the airline and whatnot and doing some things with them. And so eventually at one point, Charlie said, well, we got to get you to be one of our ferry pilots. And he explained to me that there was a group of pilots that they had, and they would call on these guys that were capable of flying the airplanes and move the airplanes around because they were, of course, all busy men. Charlie ran an auto dealership, auto mall, really, down there in Fort Worth. And then Tom, of course, was running EAA at that time. And Gene Soucy was flying for a commercial airline. So they were very busy men outside of their air show schedule. So they had a group of us that were checked out. So it turned out that we were going to try and coordinate this. And then finally, in 1984, it worked out that the Eagles were going to be flying out at Moffett Field out there, near San Francisco, Oakland area out there. And I needed to get checked out in a two-seat Eagle because, the Eagles that they flew, there was only four of them that were made as Eagle Ones, which were single seat. Frank Christensen built the three for the Eagle team and then built one for his son, John, which is known as the Black Eagle. So what we did is I airlined out to San Francisco, and Charlie and Doreen picked me up in their Cessna 340 at the time, and we flew down to Hollister to the factory there where Frank Christensen built the kits. And the airplane that's there on its tail, 2 Fox Charlie, serial number 2, I guess it is, but the very first kit airplane built was there, and we rolled it out of the hangar. So Charlie and I jumped in that airplane, and he took me out. I had done some limited aerobatics prior to this, but Charlie ran me through pretty much all of the maneuvers, maybe everything except an outside loop. And it was fantastic. Here I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I'm flying with one of the greatest aerobatic pilots in the world, and he certainly was in 1972. So we're out doing all these maneuvers, and then toward the end of it, Charlie says to me, he says, well, how about, let's see, you ever done a snap roll? And I said, no. And he said, okay, well, he talked me through the maneuver, and he showed me one, and then he showed me another, and then I attempted to do one, and after that third snap roll, I was about ready to see where my lunch had come from. So I said, okay, Charlie, I think I've kind of hit my limit there and everything else. He got a big kick out of that. So we went back and landed, and he said, Well, you think you want to try and land at Frank's Strip there, and it's quite narrow. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. Well, fortunately, I managed to, you know, keep it on the runway when I landed, and we rolled out, and I probably lost 5 pounds sweating flying the airplane. But it was just fantastic. And so the very next day, we're at the show, and I got indoctrinated in the air show circuit, so to speak. When the performers are done, people don't see that side of it. When the air show is over, the guys, the big spectators, you know, gather up their picnic baskets or whatever and their souvenirs, and they walk back to their car and go home and talk about the air show. The air show performers are busy trying to get out of Dodge, you know, and load up their airplanes. And so here I am getting a quick and dirty introduction into the world of ferrying the airplanes. Well, this particular trip, Charlie and Doreen were getting in the 340 heading back to Texas. Well, Tom was going to fly his airplane and Gino was flying his airplane. So I'm going to be in Charlie's airplane. And this is the first time I'm flown with those guys. Now, I've been at air shows with them, but this is pretty heady stuff for a guy my age here. You know, looking, these are two of my idols that I looked up to in aviation, you know, some of the best aerobatic pilots in the world. So they let me go first. And I think looking back at it now, that's what I would have done too. You know, I don't know if this guy's going to be able to keep between the lights or not. So, and you know, those airplanes are different than the two seats because they have a 260 horse Lycoming versus 200 horse. And the Eagles are unique compared to even that one that's in the museum, the Black Eagle, because they had fixed pitch propellers, two blade fixed pitch propellers. So that at that time turned out to be the loudest airplane I had ever flown. We take off and we cruise that thing at about 2,750 RPM. And of course, there's no insulation in the airplanes and whatnot. But we climbed up and we were flying eastbound, and I'm trying to get over the fact that here I'm flying formation, not real tight formation, of course, but flying formation with two guys that I've looked up to since I started going to Oshkosh in 71. And I'm looking over, and there's, you know, Tom was flying lead and I was over on the right wing and Gino's on the left. And so I'm just trying to take this all in, and I only wish that I would have had a GoPro camera back in the day, because the things I was seeing was really amazing. But so after we're flying along, and you know, Gene is quite a character, you know, he's a real jokester and a lot of fun to be around. And so all of a sudden he starts inching toward me. Well, I'm busy concentrating, just staying in position with Tom and all that, you know, looking at the lead, and pretty soon I can hear him coming close to me. And so we're talking amongst each other. He says, hey, you're looking pretty good over there, Charlie Hillard, you know. And I said, come on, Gino, quit teasing me and everything. I'll leave you alone, you know. And I look over and he says, hey, you know, look to your left. Well, he had tucked his lower wing in to where the wingtip was behind the aileron of my airplane, Charlie's airplane. He was in about as close as you could be. And I took a quick glance over there, and it just startled me to think that he was that close. And I could feel his propeller. You know, I could feel the vibration from his propeller right there. And I said, Gino, you're making me nervous, you know. And he's laughing the whole time. So he backs off just enough to get away from me and then rolls right over from left to right, over the top of me, back into position, right side up on my right wing. I mean, just incredible. And like I say, to have recorded that, but that's forever imprinted in my mind to experience that. But so we landed for fuel, and then ended up in Omaha because I think they had a show that following weekend, and we didn't fly the airplanes at night because there were no lights on them. But we got to Omaha, and then we spent the night and then airlined out the next day to get home. So but that was just my very first trip in the wow. Eagle and flying with two legends of aerobatics.
How long did you fly for the team?
I did about 3 years, and what happened is, you know, I would get tapped for the longer flights. It was myself and a couple other guys who retired airline pilots, Jack Winthrop, who retired from Braniff, and Del Booth, who was retired from Frontier. I flew with them a lot. I flew some shorter trips, but one fun thing I was going to tell you, and it happens to involve Gene as well, but I was flying an airplane from Pensacola. They had a show down there. And we were flying back, trying to make it back to Fort Worth, and the weather was a little skunky, you know, low clouds and whatnot. So as we got into Mississippi, we're flying along, but there was an area where it was somewhat clear. And I was flying Tom's airplane, and Del Booth was flying Charlie's airplane, and Gene was flying his airplane. So we're flying along, and as only Gene Susie could do, he says, "Hey, there's an airplane over here. We heard them on the frequency. They're getting ready to drop a jumper." And Gene says, "Hey, I think I'm going to go over and take a look at these guys," or something like that. And I thought, take a look at it. What are you talking about? This guy came jumping out of a 182 or something about 6,000 feet. Gene went over there, and just like the beginning of an air show, he turned his smoke system on and circled this jumper.
Oh,
jeez. And can you imagine you're flying, you know, you're a guy going jumping out of a 182 by yourself somewhere in rural Mississippi, and all of a sudden a Christian Eagle joins up on you, starts putting smoke on, and follows you down to the ground, circling like it's the beginning of an air show. I often wonder who that guy was, and I'll guarantee he probably never stopped talking about that. But that was kind of an interesting experience.
Wow. That really had to mean a lot to you to get to fly with those guys and know that they were trusting you with their aircraft.
Well, exactly. And you know, when you think about it now, and every time I go to the museum, I have to take a moment in the atrium there, and I look up at those airplanes, because I have a relationship with all three of those airplanes, having flown them, and the memories start coming back. And then, you know, the airplane down in the, you know, aerobatic area there, Two Fox Charlie, well, that's the one that Charlie checked me out in. And I remember when I was going down to, I went to, in 2018, to the Wright Brothers banquet for the first time, and that was the celebration of the Apollo 8 deal. But one of my buddies with the airline, I told him, I said, "Yeah, I'm looking forward to being there." I said, "You know, there's four airplanes in that museum that I've flown myself." And my buddy says to me, "Well, what does that say about you, Jeff?" I never thought of it that way. I don't think I'll ever end up in a museum, but nevertheless, I love going to the museum and all that. So, I did that from 84 to 86. And then what happened is it became more difficult because I upgraded to captain in 87. Well, then you go to the bottom of the seniority list, and I never had weekends off for a number of years then after that. So I wasn't able to do it after that. But I was able to go to their very last show they did in Daytona Beach, and they got all of us together that could make it. And that was real special to, you know, they celebrated 25 years as a team, the longest team to ever fly in the air show circuit for that long. And that was real special because we had pictures taken of us, those of us ferry pilots and all that were there. And that was a great time to be with all the guys and reminisce about the being together, you know, because it was a big organization that was all drawn together by those three great guys.
Right. Now, Jeff, I would imagine that during those few years as the ferry pilot, there's a lot of pressure on you. You just, as you said, you're flying airplanes that belong to some of your heroes, in some cases flying alongside them or being formated upon by somebody like Gino. But I would expect that, maybe you can answer this, generally speaking, were the three airplanes usually sort of traveling together, or were there ever cases when they were sort of spread out? And then kind of part two of that question is, did you ever find yourself in a position where, there's some of the get there-itis, this airplane's got to be there, they've got a show to do, and you just had to say no because of weather or mechanical issue?
Well, in answer to the first part of your question there, you know, it was kind of a, like I said, heady experience when you're flying airplanes that belong to the guys you idolize. Generally, the airplanes move by themselves. That particular trip I was telling you about, we had to land because it was, pushing VFR minimums. So we landed, I can't remember where the town was, but it might have been in eastern part of Texas. We were trying to make our way back to Fort Worth because they had a show the following weekend. But we landed there, and the next day we started to leave, and I was, as I mentioned, flying Tom's airplane, and I did a run-up, and we had a little issue mechanically where it wasn't an oil pressure problem. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but it might have been a gauge problem, if I recall right. But no one ever pushed you to do that. Those guys were consummate professionals in everything they did. And so there was never any pressure, and the airplanes generally moved. But what happened is I had to get back and fly an airline trip. So I had to leave the airplane the next day and get back to Dallas, and because I had to go fly an airline trip the next day. So they went back, and being that it was close enough to Fort Worth, they went back and got that airplane Dell and Gino got back to the Dallas-Fort Worth area themselves the next day, but I had to go. So they went back and got the airplane. Unfortunately, it wasn't that far away to do it. So, but for the most part, they moved together, and we always had plenty of time. There was one time we did a midweek trip. They did a show out in the Sacramento area at a private airstrip each year. The name escapes me right now, but I do know it was near Beale Air Force Base where the SR-71 was. And it was such an exclusive place that they used to get the Air Force to do a, shall we say, a flyby in an SR-71 occasionally at that air show. So that was midweek. So we ferried the airplanes from South Bend to Sacramento in a day and a half. That was pretty interesting. And we did some really long days, but great fun doing it. But we had to get the airplanes out there as quickly as possible because it wasn't the following weekend. It was that midweek deal. So that was the only time I remember that. And then there was never any pressure, like I say, to do that. And I think, you know, it speaks volumes about the guys, but you're dealing with some really fine individuals. You know, Charlie and Tom and Gene were just wonderful guys to be around, and so giving. And you know, they accepted me. One thing I remember one time, the first landing we made, and it wasn't exactly really a good one, and I kind of bounced it in, and I actually went around, and Gino was on the frequency, and he says, "Geez, Jeff, you land a Boeing that way?" And I was so embarrassed, you know, because they were waiting at the edge of the runway for me. Oh, and I came back around and got it on the ground, but I thought, what an idiot. These guys probably think I'm going to tear Charlie's airplane up, you know, and go around. But, you know, two safest maneuvers in aviation, 180-degree turn and a go-around. So anyway, there was Jocko's voice talking to me once again, but they waited for me at the edge of the runway, and we taxied in as a team. And I thought I was heaping ashes on my head because I said, you know, I'd probably embarrass them, you know, and thinking, Charlie Hillard? That's not Charlie Hillard. Of course not. it's just some kid who gets to fly his airplane. So, and Hal, forgive me, that second part of your question was,
Actually, you really hit them both.
Did I segue into that?
Yeah. It was, actually just perfectly. We were just asking about, you know, were they often the three of you traveling together? Were you coming from disparate locations?
And
the get there, any of the get there itis or the weather issues and stuff. That's a fascinating period.
Yeah. You know, there was some days where you wanted to get the airplanes there, but, no one ever pressured you, to ever do anything. I don't know. It never happened when I was doing it, but I would imagine with some days it would have been a little bit tough getting in because of the weather. But that's, you know, I have a special respect for the ferry pilots, for all the performers, because, you know, not all people don't understand or may not understand that a lot of the performers are busy people. You know, Sean D. Tucker and everybody else, they've got things. So they actually have ferry pilots that handle the airplanes for them. Because a lot of times they have other responsibilities, you know, that they have to tend to. And flying your airplane cross-country eats up a lot of time, as you might imagine, especially when you have weather to deal with. So that's how it all worked out. But really a wonderful experience. I got to meet a lot of people. It's like the traveling circus. I loved every minute of it. You know?
That's a great comparison. Well, Jeff, looking at the clock, I can see that somehow or other the time has flown right on by, and we are coming up to the end of this episode. So, Jeff Kilpinen, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the Green Dot and share some of these stories, a look at a part of the airshow industry that a lot of people may not know that much about. So thanks so much again.
Well, I thank you both very much. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
The pleasure was all ours. And speaking of thanks, thanks as always to our listeners, everybody out there who takes the time to download and or stream this show. We really, really appreciate anybody who can give us a review. It's been a little while since we've had a review over on iTunes. So if that's where you get your podcast, please head over there and give us a rating and write us a review. Or anywhere you consume your podcasts, so Google Play, Stitcher, all the other things out there. You can even, I don't know if you can leave a review, but you can find us even on Amazon at audible.com. And actually, yeah, you can leave a review there. You can even hear us on your Alexa device. Just ask her to play EAA's The Green Dot podcast. So with that, thank you once again. If you want to reach out to us directly, you can send email to feedback@eaa.org, or you can go over to each episode's landing page at inspire.eaa.org and leave comments there as well. So with all of that said, thanks again for listening. Thanks for the ongoing feedback, and we'll catch up to you next time when you're cleared to land on the Green Dot.